Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Big developments happening as we are inching our way towards the Brian Walsh murder trial. Big developments in terms of what Brian Walsh is saying he is responsible for and not responsible for after now almost 3 years of saying, I had nothing to do with any of it. We're going to break all of this down in these new developments and these challenges. Right before jury selection, Brian walked into court, raises his hand, and admits to two extremely serious charges, misleading investigators and willfully conveying or disposing of Anna Walsh's remains, the person he is also charged with murdering, his wife. But he keeps his not guilty plea to murder. It's an unusual split. It's big, it's strategic, and it raises a ton of legal questions. We're going to break it all down right now. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, is with us to help answer these questions. I want to break it down from both angles, the prosecution's interpretation and what you as a defense attorney would be thinking right now. If this were your client, let's just kind of start here and lay out what it is we're actually looking at. What does this plea actually mean? Eric.
Sure. So, Tony, it means a few things. One is that he will sustain convictions for those charges, misleading the police and also disposing of the body. And those charges are not unserious. I think misleading police carries approximately up to 10 years, the other charge up to 3 years. So some serious prison time on the table already. And then from there, the real question is going to be, how could these pleas affect the presentation of evidence at trial and affect what the jury hears, what they're allowed to consider, and what they're allowed to infer from them?
Why not just admit, hey, I did it? Why not just go all in for all of this? I mean, that's, as a layperson, my thought was, well, he's admitting part of this. Why not just go full bore?
You know, Stacey, it reminds me a little bit of the Robert Durst trial in Texas, where he was alleged to have killed a neighbor and disposed of the body. He couldn't beat the charge of disposing of the body, so he ultimately conceded that happened. In fact, I don't know if he was actually charged with that, but he made that concession to say, hey, I mishandled this situation horribly on the back end, but that doesn't mean I killed this person. And he was acquitted of the murder of that neighbor. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there's a similar strategy here.
Oh boy.
Which, I mean, this sort of thing happens all too often. And not because not every time someone dies in the presence of another is it murder. It's just not. But people tend to make really horrible decisions when put into really tough circumstances. And then you mix anything else that might have been going on here. This was New Year's Eve night into New Year's Day. I know they had a guest over. Some of the allegations were they had, you know, been drinking, enjoying themselves and whatnot. And then by like 3 or 4 in the morning, Brian is making these horrific Google searches about how to dispose of a body and all these things relating to how to deal with one who has died in a very inconspicuous way where others won't find out about it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that he killed her. Something else could have happened. She could have fallen downstairs. She could have something. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. Is there a likelihood that something happened? Sure, that's why he's on trial. But that's basically what the argument is right now. It's essentially, from understanding right, is, yeah, I did these things to conceal this, but it doesn't mean I actually killed her, right?
That's totally my read on it, Tony. And like you said, distasteful as such a position might be, it doesn't require a conclusion that he killed his wife. Like you said, there could have been an accident that happened. Perhaps there was someone else present during the night who had some involvement, and then he freaked out and he panicked. And I think that that'll probably be the narrative that the defense presents at trial. Like you said, this was chaotic. He didn't know what to do, and he was scared. And so he took the action he did. But that action is not equivalent to someone being guilty of murder, at least in and of itself.
So let me ask you this. Let me interject for just a second. So you're at a party. We've got the holidays coming. Your family comes over for Thanksgiving, and Uncle Bill starts choking on, a turkey bone and dies, and everybody panics. Do people need to be afraid to alert the authorities if someone dies in front of you?
Yes, hide it as quickly as possible. Don't tell anyone.
But doesn't it just conjure up these pictures of, you call 911 if somebody dies in front of you, don't you? I mean, what are we fearing here? What are we supposed to do?
Stacey, that would be the common knowledge, right? If there's an accident that caused the death in which there was no foul play, you would think that, oh my gosh, my relatives, something bad happened to them. Let's call the police and go through the normal processes. But I think defense is going to say at trial, he wasn't thinking normally. It wasn't a normal situation. He didn't know what to do. He got scared, and he made a horrible decision. But when an accident happens, there's no necessarily criminal implications to reporting that accident to police.
And it's not like we have a track record of Brian Welsh being a great decision maker. From what we understand of him, what we know of him, he's sitting there on New Year's Eve wearing an ankle monitor because of his forged Andy Warhol photo or paintings that he, was selling online. So you got this going on. You have a wife that some allegations are that she was having an affair, that she was unhappy, that she wanted to leave. I can't imagine why she'd want to get away from such a winning man that she has here. So you have all these internal dynamics going on. And if you're already a bad decision maker, add a little alcohol to the mix. And that's just my own conjecture. I'm assuming it's New Year's. I don't know. Brian doesn't seem like he makes great choices, so I'm going to guess maybe there's some of that in the mix. And you're looking at the optics of this going, my wife is dead. Let's just play this for a moment that he didn't do something to her. Let's play it that she fell down the stairs or something. Something happened that she died that he was not truly responsible for, just for the sake of the argument. He's looking at the image and the optics of this. Already looks like an untrustworthy, shitty human being. Already has the ankle monitor. So with that being out there, you get caught committing another crime or even connected to one, you might go away pretty quickly, and you probably don't want that. And God knows what else. He may not want dug up of what's going on around him and his life of thievery. And then you have the allegations that she's unhappy, that friends probably know she's unhappy, that she wants to get out of this, but she is still there. And so there could be some jealousy at play here. It could look pretty bad. The first thing you're going to think of, he killed his wife, even if you don't have any sort of evidence to it. So the idea that one may freak out and try to cover it up a bit isn't completely out of the question if the person is not a good decision maker, which he is not already. But the problem is there's so many other dark possibilities here that lean a lot more in the area of he probably killed her. Then it's a horrible accident. If there's a horrible accident, you typically don't have like a bloody knife in the basement. You don't typically have, her DNA down there as well with blood, and you have different things of hers at different dumpsters. That's not normal. That's not just accident. But he, if he's coming out here and he's saying, yes, I did, essentially part of it is I concealed the truth here. And with this body of my wife, he could argue and he could say, I panicked. And yes, I did dismember her, but I didn't kill her. I dismembered her because I was trying to get rid of the body. That's why you have knife. That's why you have blood on this knife. That's why you have blood here. I'm curious as to how dark do you think this is going to get, Eric, when they try to start arguing this in court and start going down the road of what the hell they're going to say Brian was actually doing that night, where he did this, but not that.
Right. You know, I think it's going to play out something like, you know, defense is going to say, hey, look, being scared and being stupid is one thing, but that's not the same as being a murderer. And I think what they're going to say is that he realized people would perceive him as having a motive here, and he freaked out and made a horrible decision. And I think defense is also going to try to limit the evidence regarding misleading the police and limit the evidence regarding disposal of the body, because they're going to say, hey, it's no longer at issue. These aren't charges the jury has to decide. We don't need to go into, you know, days of testimony and evidence and photographs about all of this. These charges have been concluded. And so really the real question is whether he caused the death of this person, for which there is less evidence.
But is the judge going to go with that? Is the judge going to say, okay, yeah, you pled guilty to these charges. We're all originally part of the same big case. And suddenly, just because you're now going to admit accountability to some of these, I mean, they do play into the rest of the case in many ways. Is a judge logically really going to say that these other steps in this case no longer are applicable because they play more to motives that he's admitting to, not necessarily to the actual crime of murder itself, but more so to the crime of cover-up? Because that's where all the Google searches and stuff come in. Those are the pretty damning things that would make almost anyone get convicted of murder. Is a judge going to throw those sort of things out? This is a really interesting strategic move on the part of his defense.
You know, I liken it to, and it's not perfectly analogous, but let's say there's like a vehicular homicide case where someone kills another person with an automobile, and then they don't report that accident. They just flee the scene because they're scared. And so they might argue later that, hey, we'll plead guilty to fleeing the scene, hit and run. But the question remains, was my client at fault for the accident? Did they, you know, meet the elements of vehicular homicide and cause this in the way that the law requires it be proved? That question remains. That being said, I think this evidence is certainly relevant to whether he killed her or not. I think the judge is not going to give Brian Walsh any sympathetic favors here, and will probably determine, hey, this, even though these charges are separate, the evidence supporting these charges are still relevant to the primary charge of homicide. So it's coming in, but there might be some minor limitations.
Wow.
Are you surprised that it's going to trial? This is one that I honestly thought early on with the cascade of evidence that had come out, the Google searches, especially the evidence in the house, the dumpster, you know, findings of what's been out there, obviously no body, but there was a lot that pointed directly to Brian Walsh and his involvement in this, the cleanup stuff from Home Depot, all of it. I mean, you put it all together and it's like, this guy's guilty as shit.
It feels
what do you think was going on behind the scenes here? Do you think that an attorney was sitting there saying, look, we need to like kind of go for a plea here or something, because this is not defensible. There's no way I can spin this that's going to make any sort of sense at all. And do you think this was a compromise between the client, between Brian and his attorney of, I'm not going to admit to the murder, but go ahead and we'll plea to these things. Even though the attorney knows flat out, like, well, you're screwed no matter what, but okay, fine. We'll just go to pleading these couple things because that'll make Brian happy, the poor decision maker that he is.
you know, it's a horrific look for Brian Walsh. All of this circumstantial evidence of the searches and the biological material and the apparent weapons within the vicinity. All of that is a huge problem. But from a defense standpoint, just kind of playing devil's advocate, mm-hmm. anytime you don't have the body, you mm-hmm. probably don't have cause of death. And so the prosecution has to prove that. They have to prove how this person was murdered if they're bringing a murder charge, at least in general terms. And I wonder if it was just sort of a strategic 11th hour decision to say, and you know, perhaps he was being pressured by his counsel to consider a plea offer. And this is a way for his counsel to be able to argue, hey, look, he's owned up to what he did. He's been straight with this jury, whether that's true or not. About the actions that he took, but he's not going to admit to something he didn't do. And the cause of death is something he didn't do. And the prosecution can't prove to you how that happened. That might be the horse's defense rides at trial.
So we don't know if she was killed or if she just died. So who knows? There's your doubt where the jury is going to sit there and go, I don't know how we're doing this.
Right. Well, and I mean,
is it reasonable?
That's a debatable question for sure. But, you know, I think his counsel for cross-examination, it's going to look something like, hey, you know, can you tell this jury conclusively that she died of a gunshot wound? No. Can you tell the jury she died of a stab wound? How about a ligature strangling? How about a poisoning? Can you tell the jury anything about how this person died? And if the prosecution doesn't have at least some kind of satisfactory response, the jury might think to themselves, hey, is that doubt as to cause of death? And is it reasonable doubt? But yeah, that reasonable piece, Tony, is something that's certainly debatable.
I mean, is he... If you're going to go down this road and you're going to have this defense of, yes, I played a role in disposing of my wife's body. And yeah, that's why I made these Google searches. That's why this happened. And it explains those things away. Is he required? I mean, is there a way they can walk around this in some way, shape, or form and not answer the question of how she died? I would think that the defense is, if you're going to go down this road, you're going to have to come up with something as to, here's how she died, and here's why I reacted the way I did. Would you not? Or can you just simply sew? Is that part of the mystery? Is that part of the sowing of the doubt of, she's dead, here's what he did with the remains, but he's under no obligation to tell you exactly how she died. All he has to say is that he didn't do it.
Completely a question that will be ever present in the jury's minds is like, hey, if this dude was so involved with the immediate aftermath, wouldn't he know something about the precursors, about what led to this? But that being said, defense could say, hey, look, he's got a constitutional right not to testify. And you know, people don't have to put themselves on the stand and be peppered with questions by a seasoned DA. He's already told you what he did via the convictions. And I think that probably protects him from having to testify about the disposal of the body and about misleading the police, because the facts of convictions, the court can take judicial notice of those. And so he doesn't have to get on the stand and say, hey, here's what happened after. Here's why I did it. I'm so sorry. I freaked out. Instead, his attorney can argue that at closing without him being subject to cross-examination about the gruesome details of how that entire thing played out.
And what a horrible, let's take the human aspect here. Anna's family hearing this, you know, hearing these details about how she was disposed of. You know, they didn't get a proper burial, a proper ceremony, anything of that nature. Maybe now they have, but it's just disgusting. And so they have to live with these details now.
And there's kids.
Yeah.
There are children involved here mm-hmm. that... So for the last 3 years, essentially, he's been lying to the family, lying to his kids, lying to everybody about his involvement, about anything. Oh, by the way, daddy did chop up mommy and went to Home Depot and got all this stuff. And I mean, it's not like there was any real question that he didn't do those things. It's pretty black and white data that's there that's showing that he did. But here's why, basically, because I was scared and I needed to do something. That's not going to read well to a jury either. I mean, none of this looks good to a jury. Why? I guess the question is, why now? Why are they even doing this? Why do you think they decided right before jury selection, we're going to throw this shit to the table and see what it does? What, I mean, what is the goal?
What I've seen before, Tony, and what my apprehension is that it allows the defense to take responsibility for some of the horrible things that happen without taking full responsibility for the death of the alleged victim, and to argue to the jury that, hey, he's come to the table and he's owned up to what he did. And you know, he's been convicted of those things. He'll be punished for those things. But they can't prove that he did the murder piece of this, and it allows them to sort of tell the jury he's taking responsibility without him needing to get on the stand, take responsibility, and then perhaps be completely annihilated by some sort of cross-examination about the details.
I mean, does the bigger man argument work here when he's lied for the last 2 years, misled police investigations and all? I mean, I would think that a jury's going to go, okay, well, if you're the bigger man and you really cared about your wife and getting justice for her or just dealing with reality on reality's terms for the sake of your family, these children and everyone around you, you're not the bigger man. You've literally lied for the last 3 years about all of this. And there's probably not like a real killer somewhere if it's going to be an accident type defense, because I'm guessing he's not going to say someone swooped in, murdered her, and then went off into the night. But who knows? Anything, I guess, is possible. The optics of I'm doing the right thing now, I feel like it comes a little bit too little too late.
Oh, it could ring very hollow for this jury. And you're right. He has allegedly a history of deception, not only deceiving the police in his wife's disappearance and disposal of her body, but also in prior fraud issues. You know, he allegedly sold these Andy Warhol paintings that were fraudulent for tens of thousands of dollars or something. He was ordered to pay like $400,000 plus in that case. So he's not the kind of, you know, saint who's coming forward and saying, hey, look, I'm owning up to this. I did it. In terms of disposing of the body. And so, yeah, the jury, especially if he tries to argue that he's taken responsibility of being straight with them, the prosecutor might on rebuttal say, oh, well, you know, there's a reason you shouldn't trust Brian Walsh. And not only is it this case, but it's other cases too.
I was going to ask, are they allowed to bring in that previous charge with the Andy Warhol stuff?
It's going to be a really sort of tedious evidentiary question, Stacey, because if the defendant testifies, then prior acts of dishonesty are typically admissible. But what about if the defendant doesn't testify and the fact of the convictions are the only thing that comes in? Does that qualify as a statement from the defendant that can be impeached by prior acts of dishonesty? It's almost like a law school exam. It gets to be a very sort of convoluted evidentiary analysis, and there's no clear-cut answer. It'll be up to the judge.
Damn.
At this point, do you think he is going to testify? Do you, I mean, we're obviously, that's kind of like a last ditch effort here, but I'm wondering, it feels like they're throwing Hail Marys right now and we're not even into the trial. That's why I'm wondering, like, I don't know that you're going to be able to sell your story with the witnesses that you're about to present. And if especially when you've just come out and said that you handled the body and lied to police for the last 3 years. I would think you would need to be on that stand to tell your side of the story if you have a chance in hell of a jury believing you.
You know, I think it's hard to say. There's always pitfalls and perils with a defendant testifying. Brian Walsh strikes me as kind of a audacious fellow, sort of someone who is a risk taker, who might have a diluted sense of self-confidence. And so perhaps he chooses, because it'll be up to him, not his attorneys. It's up to Brian whether he wants to testify. And if he does get up there, you know, are there other witnesses who are present when his wife actually died. Because if not, if the other guests had already gone, then it's Brian's word, and there's no other witness that, who can be called to contradict that. It would only be cross-examination, and we'd have to see if he stood up to that sort of crucible.
Yeah, I believe the only witness that there was a friend of theirs. I think it was a friend of hers more than him. I'm just trying to recall it. And if I remember right, they talked about they had a lovely, there was like nothing amiss about the evening from the way he has described it in interviews of just, it's a lovely evening. We got together for New Year's. We had some drinks. We had some food. Then I went home at about X time and then found this out the next day of just like, holy crap. Like, what the hell happened after this? If that holds up for what it is and that there wasn't anybody else. But I believe it was just one friend that had hung out with them on New Year's, and you know, they watched Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's and had a rockin' good time, and then all this shit went down. This is a case too where it feels like they have for the many years this has been going on, has been looking for anything and everything they can possibly point to either get this thing dismissed, to put some sort of doubt into the waters, to do whatever they can. And one of those big things has been Michael Proctor, who was also, of course, of the Karen Reed case. And trying to, because he was one of the lead investigators at this at the beginning. So they were saying, well, look over here. Look all the convoluted crap that's going on over here. So it must be going on over here, too. That didn't hold a whole lot of water. None of it really came to much fruition in this case because of his own actions in this case. But when we see that they were trying to go down these kind of low-hanging fruit paths the entirety of 3 years, it reminds me of Koberger in some ways. It reminds me of a lot of cases where we got nothing, so we're going to go for anything we can possibly go for and stretch this time out as best as we can. It just feels like they may have run out of fruit.
Very well could be. And you know, when you get in dire straits as defense counsel, you've got to do what you can. And you know, especially recently, that there is a lot more, in my opinion, skepticism of police misconduct and shoddy police work. And juries really hate that. And so, you know, perhaps as defense, do you try to craft a narrative? I'm not saying I would do this necessarily, but do you try to craft a narrative that, hey, this was flawed from the outset, and you have this bad actor, this villain. Remember when he jumped to conclusions about Karen Reed and he was acquitted? That's what he did here. And that's why you have no evidence of the cause of death and everything else. At least that's how the defense argument will go. I think there are counterarguments to that kind of thing. But some jurors really latch on to say, hey, this needs to be a fair process, a fair investigation. And with this guy sort of rearing his ugly head again, can we really put our faith in what the police did here?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a fair question. It is, until you start looking at the evidence of the case and you go, Proctor had absolutely nothing to do with all of these things that Brian Walsh did on his own and chose to do on his own. And now it seems like he's trying to come up with some sort of explanation for it. But it was this bad, but not quite that bad. We'll see how that plays with the jury. It's going to be real fascinating to watch. Interested to get everyone's thoughts in the comments section on YouTube.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.